Iowans have a reputation for avoiding conflict, but that doesn't mean there aren't issues that divide us. Today, we begin our summer series, Beyond Iowa Nice. Over the next 4 weeks, we'll have conversations about those divisive issues. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, the divide between pro-life and pro-choice. I'll talk with legislators and leaders and activists in each movement. We'll examine the Iowa Senate fight over funding for Planned Parenthood, the history of this debate, the future of both movements in light of the recent Supreme Court decision striking down a Texas law that limited access to abortions, and most importantly, we'll search for common ground. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowans have a reputation for being non-confrontational. We've all heard the term Iowa nice, but that doesn't mean that there aren't issues that divide us. Today, we begin our summer series from Iowa Public Radio News, and we are going beyond Iowa nice to have conversations about difficult subjects. And we're starting today with an issue that divides many of us, abortion. We'd also like to hear from you throughout the hour during this respectful conversation. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can use the hashtag Beyond Iowa Nice or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And as the hour goes on, I'll talk with leaders and activists in the pro-life and pro-choice movements, and we'll try to understand the history of this debate. But we're going to start in the state legislature, where debate was heated over a bill that would have defunded Planned Parenthood during this session. That bill was defeated, but the debate is far from over. And with me now are Representative Megan Jones, a Republican from Sioux Rapids. She was in favor of discontinuing state funding for Planned Parenthood. Hello, Representative Jones.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. Also with us, Representative Beth Wessel-Crochel, a Democrat from Ames. She fought to remove the language from the bill that would have discontinued funding for Planned Parenthood. Hello, Representative Wessel-Crochel.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And Representative Jones, I'm going to give you an opportunity to go first and lay out your beliefs on this issue. Why is it important to you to try to discontinue funding for Planned Parenthood in Iowa?
Well, what I believe and what I believe a majority of my constituents believe is that it's important to protect life no matter what stage of development. And I believe a majority of Iowans believe that too. And that's a priority for us in the Republican caucus to protect life.
And Representative Wessel-Crochel, tell me why this issue is important to you.
Well, thousands of women depend on Planned Parenthood and other family planning clinics in Iowa for quality health care every year. 97% of what Planned Parenthood does is provide reproductive health care, meaning contraception and cancer screenings, STD screenings and treatments. These are all very important to Iowans, and that's what Planned Parenthood is known for. It's highly regarded. An Iowa poll came out in March saying that 70% of Iowans favor funding family planning for programs at Planned Parenthood. I think that Iowans support the services that Planned Parenthood provides.
Well, and Representative Jones, in listening to the list of services that Planned Parenthood provides, those are services that are very important to women all over the state of Iowa, and no state funding goes to fund abortions. So give me a little more information about why you still feel, in spite of that, that funding should be discontinued for Planned Parenthood?
Well, there are only 13 Planned Parenthood clinics in Iowa. My district doesn't have one. And there are numerous women's health care centers all throughout the state that provide comparable, if not better, services than the women's health services that Planned Parenthood does provide. But what happens that at abortion clinics, abortion providers, is that it frees up money for them to provide abortion services when they are able to offset their costs with the abortion services, with women's healthcare services. So
you're saying that you feel that there is a cost shifting. So you feel that even though the money is not specifically for those services, somehow it's still used for those services.
Right. The cost has shifted. But what the greater issue is that there's only 13 of these 13 of these providers throughout the state. And so when we're talking about providing rural Iowa women with access to healthcare centers, these aren't the abortion providers, the abortion clinics that are providing, women's healthcare services. It's not happening in rural Iowa because there's only 13 of them throughout the state, and it's not happening in my district, and it's not happening in rural Iowa. So when we're talking about making sure that we have healthcare for women in rural Iowa or for a great majority of women throughout the state, we need to make sure that all women are covered and not just the ones who happen to be around these 13 centers.
Well, one of our goals today is to find common ground and talk about ways we can move forward in the state of Iowa with some of these difficult issues. And Representative Jones, I think you just brought up one of the issues where there is a lot of common ground. And Representative Wessel Crochelle, I'd love to get your thoughts on it, because access to health care in rural areas of Iowa is a serious problem. That's not necessarily that wouldn't necessarily have been fixed by discontinuing funding to Planned Parenthood. But this is something that I'm guessing you also feel strongly about.
Oh, absolutely. I represent Ames, so we have, you know, a very good healthcare system here. But Planned Parenthood nationally, 54% of their health services are in rural and medically underserved communities. In Iowa, that's 31%. Just because the services aren't widespread enough is not a reason for me to say we need to curtail them where they are. If you talk to representatives from independent family planning providers or federally qualified health centers or private OBGYNs or public health leaders, they're all speaking out that they do not have the capacity to take in the services that Planned Parenthood provides.
So is this an issue that is separate, something that in the state legislature there needs to be a focus on, in your opinion?
In terms of making sure that
rural Iowa
has absolutely, and we have done a lot of work in that area. Sometimes it's because we can't get providers to go to rural Iowa. They want to stay in the urban areas. And so we have provided some financial incentives for students to pay for their college education, their medical school education, to go into rural Iowa. We have found that people have not taken advantage of that. We do have an internet-based secure environment where many rural Iowans are gaining access to healthcare through the internet, and that's, you know, where we are. It's not perfect, and certainly we need to continue to work on getting access for all Iowans to quality health care.
Representative Jones, I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the other goals that you and Representative Wessel Crochelle might have in common for Iowans and for rural health care. Where do you feel we should be putting our efforts in the state legislature?
Yeah, I would have to agree. You know, one bill that I think was that was highlighted this session that was just signed into law or just went into effect on July 1st was about rural pharmacies and so telepharmacies. And so what that bill did was make it easier and more accessible for rural Iowans to have greater access to pharmacies in rural Iowa. And so that's a deficiency that we saw in the state and something that we came together on a bipartisan level to see a need, and then we addressed it in the state. So I think that's a great example. While we may disagree on abortion services throughout the state and how to come around that issue, I think that's something that we can come together on, how to provide healthcare services throughout the state, in rural Iowa in particular. But then I think particularly we found a light at the end of that tunnel in the telepharmacy bill this session.
Abortion rates have declined in the state of Iowa, and I know that that's something that pretty much everyone wants to see happen. Representative Jones, why do you think abortion rates are declining in the state of Iowa?
I think we've had a greater emphasis on family planning services, and I think, you know, we have a greater access to more a diversified set of medical professionals, whether that that is a doctor or a registered nurse or another professional. But we're seeing many different options when it comes to availability of healthcare in the state of Iowa. And I think that access is becoming more widely known. So I think that's certainly helping out. But I think there's also a greater access to options. You know, in my district, we have an organization called the Cherish Center, and the Cherish Center is a wonderful place where women can go, and it connects women, young women who are pregnant with families who want to adopt, and it's a great transition for young women who want to make that decision, and then they can transition from pregnancy into adoption. And it's a great organization, and that organization has really helped foster that that decision for many families, and has really helped many families adopt, but then has also taken care of these young women who are making that decision.
And Representative Wessel Crochelle, what would you like to add to that and your thoughts about why abortion rates in Iowa have been declining? What are we doing right?
Well, we have reduced unintended pregnancies, and that can definitely be attributed to great family planning services in Iowa. One of the there's new science, or there's better science than there was. They're called long-acting reversible contraception. So a couple of those might be IUDs or implants. Those are working so much better than the birth control pill, which relied on the individual to take it every day. This is something that requires nothing of the individual and just protects against an unintended pregnancy. This research has been done by the Guttmacher Institute that shows this has just been an incredible resource for reducing the unintended pregnancies.
We have 1 minute remaining. What would you like to see the Iowa legislature focus on in the future when it comes to women's health? And Representative Wessel Crochelle, very quickly.
Absolutely. Making more access to reproductive health care across the state. If there's not access in Representative Jones' district, I think it's really important that we continue to work to make sure there is access. And in every district in this state, that people don't have to drive a half an hour or an hour to get that.
And Representative Jones, what would your priority be? Very quickly.
Well, I'd like to continue on the efforts of pro-life, but also I think we need to continue on the efforts of Common Ground. So I sponsored the original bill for the adoption tax credit, and I think that that is a really important tax credit to make sure that families have that option and that that finances don't prohibit adoption.
Well, thank you both so much for being here today. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about the abortion debate in the state of Iowa. We're kicking off our series Beyond Iowa Nice. And all this month on Talk of Iowa and River to River, every Thursday, we're going to be having conversations about some of the difficult issues that divide us in Iowa. We were just talking about the debate over funding for Planned Parenthood in the Iowa legislature this year. That's a debate that comes up annually in the state of Iowa, or has for the past 5 years. I was speaking with Representative Megan Jones, a Republican from Sioux Rapids, and Representative Beth Wessel Crochelle, a Democrat from Ames. We're going to move on and talk more with leaders and individuals who are parts of the pro-life and pro-choice movements. And I want to introduce now Mary Ziegler. She is the author of After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, and she's also Stearns Weaver Miller Professor of Law at Florida State University. Hello, Mary.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I would love for you to give us a little bit of historical perspective on this debate, because this is a debate that you say has not always been so divisive. Tell me what that means.
Sure. So I think there are two things that it's worth kind of taking apart. One is how divisive conflict about abortion itself has been. So there's a widespread myth that abortion conflict really intensified only after Roe versus Wade and because of Roe versus Wade. And most historians, myself included, think that that's wrong, and that there were really deep beliefs on either side of the debate about abortion running back really to the 1960s and before. But what was much less polarized was discussion about other women's issues. So a lot of the earlier conversation this hour about common ground would have been much easier to find across the country and really within the pro-life and pro-choice movements, not just within state legislatures. This ran on topics for everything from contraception to pregnancy discrimination legislation to better welfare protections for poor women to alleviate some of the pressures that might encourage women to terminate pregnancies they'd like to bring to term. So I think for a variety of reasons, that kind of common ground became much harder to find politically and made it much more likely that when you think of the pro-choice and pro-life movements, you think of them only fighting about abortion and not finding ways to make abortion less necessary. But that's, I think, something that's been a product of our recent past, not something that's inevitable or something we necessarily have to live with forever.
When do you think we lost that common ground?
My sense is that it had to do with a couple of things that were happening in the late 70s and early 80s. The biggest thing was that both political parties, the Democratic and Republican Party, took very strong positions on abortion and made abortion into a wedge issue politically. That hadn't been true before. In fact, both parties didn't want to touch abortion with a 10-foot pole for some time. After that happened, it made it much harder for either side to publicly be willing to see compromise for a few reasons. The first was that the pro-life movement, which had been interested in solutions that would make women less pressured to seek abortion, had a harder time doing that in certain instances when working with Republicans, at least at the national level, because the Republican Party wasn't interested necessarily in beefing up laws against workplace discrimination or welfare protections. The kind of small government solution Republicans favored didn't really fit very well within this agenda of alternatives to abortion that would help particularly poor women. The other thing that was happening simultaneously was that neither side really wanted to appear willing to compromise, because if you're trying to convince a party to do what you want politically, a willingness to compromise is a weakness, it's a liability. And so people began discarding that too. And finally, I think at the same time, the pro-life movement, which had been fairly isolated in spite of efforts to find partners both on the right and left politically, finally found a very strong ally in the religious right. And the religious right, of course, was socially conservative, not just on abortion, but on a variety of other issues, including birth control and sex education and even certain forms of anti-discrimination legislation. So at that point, for the pro-life movement to have the kind of political relevance, voice, and financial security it wanted, it was much harder to talk about women's issues in a way that would make common ground easier to find. So these were all things that didn't have to happen. These aren't necessarily even our current political realities, but they've made it such that if you talk to most people in Iowa or across the country, they identify the pro-life movement with republicanism and conservatism. They identify the pro-choice movement with feminism and the Democratic Party, and they see very little common ground or even possibility of common ground between the two sides. Again, I don't think that things have to be that way, but that's where we are now as a product of our history.
Right now, our nation seems to be so divided in so many ways. But, you know, I was just talking to a Republican and a Democratic state legislators that were on the opposite sides of this issue. They had a lot in common. They both clearly care a great deal about their female constituents and their health and their access to health care. Do you think that there is a possibility that we will reach that kind of common ground on a national level? Again.
I do think it's possible. I was just, after the Supreme Court just decided a big abortion case this week, and I had written some op-eds about it, and people were contacting me afterward, both pro-life and pro-choice people, saying now is the time to try to find common ground nationally. because clearly, at least for the time being, Roe v. Wade isn't going anywhere. And so pro-life people who've been investing so much in a strategy to get rid of Roe have time and energy to do something else. So why not now try to do the kind of thing nationally that your state legislators were describing, which is to sort of find ways to make women less desperate when they're pregnant, more able to access quality health care. I do think that's possible. I think it's harder at the national level simply because both parties have these very strong relationships with the opposing movements. And the parties themselves are hopelessly polarized at the national level, as all of us know all too well. So I think that's the biggest stumbling block, how to, for the movements to kind of find solutions that might work for everyone, even if the parties and even if Congress might not be willing to work across the aisle in the same way.
I'm talking with Mary Ziegler. She's the author of After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, and she's also Stearns Weaver Miller Professor of Law at Florida State University. And Mary, stay with us. I want to bring a couple of other voices into this conversation, people who have dedicated their careers to working on this issue. With me, Jessica Mason Piclo. She is Vice President for Law and the Courts at Rewire, a media organization dedicated to covering reproductive health rights and justice. Hello, Jessica.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Also with us, Jennifer Bowen, who is Executive Director of Iowa Right to Life. Hello, Jennifer.
Good morning.
Thank you for being on the show today. And Jessica, I'll start with you. When you're listening to Mary talk about the kinds of common ground that maybe used to exist in this national debate and seem to exist on some level. Let's talk about the goals of your organization, and then we'll talk about those areas where we may be able to find common ground. First of all, tell me a little bit about the primary aims of Rewire.
Sure. So we are a reproductive health and social justice media organization. We dedicate ourselves to evidence-based reporting and analysis on issues involving all areas of reproductive health from cradle to grave. So obviously, part of that includes contraception, abortion, and family planning.
All right. And Jennifer, can you tell us what the aims are of Iowa Right to Life?
Absolutely. Iowa Right to Life is the largest pro-life organization in the state of Iowa, and we focus our efforts on the human rights issues of abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia.
All right. So some of the issues that Jessica was talking about there, looking for better access for women's health care, that doesn't sound like that's necessarily covered by what your goals are. Is that part of Right to Life in Iowa?
Again, we focus on those issues, primarily abortion, infanticide, euthanasia. There are other issues that come into play there. But as you can imagine, just focusing on those specific issues is a daunting enough task in our society.
Jessica, sometimes it feels like, and just as Mary was saying, it feels like the issue of abortion overshadows all of the other issues for women's reproductive health. In your work, what do you feel your primary goals are? What are the most important things?
Well, the most important things, I see these, frankly, as a couple parallel paths since we're having a conversation on common ground here. One of the fundamental goals of my work as a journalist and my organization's work and those others of us who promote science-based and evidence-based reporting is to, first and foremost, make sure that the fundamental humanity of pregnant people is recognized in our society and the law, and that that is free from state coercion at all levels. A second and important part of that is explaining that abortion, contraception, sterilization, IVF, all of these areas of reproductive health care are but one or two or three components to what it means to access comprehensive health care generally. And when we pick apart those, particularly for women, what we are creating is an inherently and structurally discriminatory health care system. And so we need to be addressing both of those things simultaneously.
Is reducing the number of abortions part of the goal of your organization, reducing this demand for abortions?
I don't understand the point of framing this as a demand for abortion. We don't talk about a demand for vasectomies or a demand for colonoscopies. People need the health care that they need. And so to the extent that we want to decrease the amount of abortion, what we actually want to do is increase the access to health care.
And Jennifer, I know that you were saying with the Iowa Right to Life, you know, abortion is one of the primary focuses of what you do. Is decreasing the circumstances that lead women to seek abortion, is that part of your goal as well?
Without a doubt. I think I'd like to take a step back and respond to some of the things that were just said. The first is, I think it's important to remember that the act of abortion is the intentional killing of a human being. And so terminating the pregnancy, you know, sterilizing terms, you know, it needs to come back to the reality that within every abortion, a baby loses his life, the intentional act of killing a person. That's important, first of all, to remember. Secondly, what's important to remember is abortion is not healthcare. Iowa Right to Life is completely supportive of women and children, whether that's in the womb, out of the womb. But abortion and healthcare, number one, are not synonymous. Iowa Right to Life has been speaking over the last number of years, especially like you mentioned several minutes ago about the defunding of the abortion industry conversation at the State House. Iowa Right to Life has continually pointed out that in the state of Iowa, we have at least 214, if not more, federally qualified health care centers that are around the state of Iowa that we are in favor of supporting over the abortion industry, because in those centers, women are able to access true whole women's health care. And so I think it's important to just keep that in mind that, you know, yes, the conversation is polarizing, but it is absolutely vital that we understand that abortion is not healthcare.
Okay, you've clarified your personal views there, but you didn't answer my question, which is that part of your goal to give women access to the kind of healthcare that would prevent unwanted pregnancies?
I just responded by saying that we are in favor of women receiving treatment at federally qualified healthcare centers, where they are able to access all of the healthcare options that may be needed for them. So, is the question being, is are we in favor of eliminating abortion one at a time? Absolutely. I mean, we are very excited to see that abortion rates in the state of Iowa are decreasing 40% since 2007. To us, that's a very encouraging trend, because what that is indicating is women are given the opportunity to have more abortion access in the state of Iowa than ever before through telemedicine abortions, and they're choosing other options. So yes, it's going to be that we want to see less abortions, but our ultimate goal is to see a true restoration of all sanctity and dignity of all human life, from fertilization to natural death.
And thank you for clarifying that for me. Mary, I want to turn to you, because I think that we've reached a point that really illustrates what you were talking about earlier, where the divide over definition of life creates a sort of a barrier to conversation. And this is exactly what you were talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem, one of the problems, I think, is just that social movements are diverse. And so it can be very hard to get, you know, if you want national or even state level pro-choice or pro-life organizations to say, okay, we're going to pick common ground, for example, on contraception. Because it may be that some pro-life people feel that a lot of forms of contraception are objectionable because they actually are the same thing as abortion, or because sex outside of marriage or before marriage is wrong, or something like that. So some of the obstacles, I think, just speak to the fact that when you have a social movement, the kind of the common ground within that movement is the issues that unfortunately divide us, right, like abortion. I think the other issue is just one of almost how people understand one another. The abortion issue is so heated, and it goes so deeply to core beliefs about who we are and what we believe, that it's hard, I think, for people to even believe that people on the other side are coming at this from a position of good faith, even if they disagree with them. And in doing the research for my book, I did something like over 100 oral histories with people who had very different beliefs about abortion, and people sent me things they didn't need to send. They were very nice. People who said things I would have found scary or weird at the beginning of the project turned out to be really wonderful, lovely people. And so I think that's another obstacle to finding common ground, just that people don't necessarily know people who disagree with them about abortion. And if they don't know people, it's easy to imagine that these are just bad people who don't understand anything about what's moral or right in the world. In my experience as a historian, I've found that not to be true, at least of the people I've studied. But I think when it comes to something that speaks so much to our core values, it's very hard for people who are on the ground level waging this war sometimes to believe that. And I can understand easily why that would happen.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Jessica and Jennifer, please, both of you, stay with us for a few more minutes. With me, Mary Ziegler, author of After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, Jennifer Bowen, executive director of Iowa Right to Life, and Jessica Mason Piclo of Rewire, a media organization dedicated to covering reproductive health rights and justice. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are having a difficult conversation. That's the goal of this month on Talk of Iowa and River to River. We're going beyond Iowa Nice to talk in depth about some of the issues that really divide us, the kinds of conversations we may avoid having on a regular basis. And with me now, Mary Ziegler, author of After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. She's also Stearns Weaver Miller Professor of Law at Florida State University. Jennifer Bowen is here. She's executive director of Iowa Right to Life, and Jessica Mason Piclo, vice president for law and the courts at Rewire, a media organization dedicated to covering reproductive health rights and justice. And Jessica and Jennifer, you've both done a very nice job of laying out your beliefs and what you are working for with your organizations. And Jessica, I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about what you see your movement, the pro-choice movement, moving toward in the future. What are your priorities?
Well, our first and most important priority is making sure that everybody has full comprehensive reproductive health care as possible. But I also think that in order to get that, we need to expand the conversation about what the various attacks on us look like. So we've talked a little bit about abortion restrictions, and the Supreme Court weighed in very forcefully on that to say that when legislators try to restrict abortion access in the name of patient safety, they need to have the data to back that up. And so that's a very important debate, particularly in the state of Iowa with regards to the various efforts to kill off its telemedicine program and for those rural Iowans who need access to health care in the state. I also think it's important that we talk about the impact of Catholic consolidation of health care, because even if those hospitals and clinics exist, if they happen to be religiously affiliated, there's no guarantee that as a woman you will get access to reproductive health care at those facilities. And then I also think finally we need to talk about the fact that there are women in this country right now sitting in prison for attempts to terminate pregnancies or have what state law enforcement officials considered a suspicious miscarriage. And, you know, that is something that traditionally the anti-choice movement has opposed, but what we're seeing is a real shift in that. You know, Purvi Patel is in Indiana jail right now serving 20 years on contradictory charges of neglecting a dependent and feticide, and for effectively what has been described as a criminal miscarriage. And if we're going to have a serious conversation about in this country about what it means to have full access to not just healthcare, but civil rights, these are parts of the conversation that we must include in this so-called debate over abortion rights.
We haven't found a lot of common ground in this part of the conversation. Jessica, do you see any common ground with the pro-life movement?
Well, I mean, I would hope that the common ground is that the fundamental humanity of women should be first and foremost. I mean, I would really sincerely hope that. And, you know, the other thing, though, is that I believe it's difficult for those of us who really do believe in full human rights for everyone to talk about common ground, because what we hear is that we are supposed to find a place on our humanity to compromise. And that just doesn't seem like a good place to start from.
Jessica, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Anytime.
Jessica Mason Piccolo, Vice President for Law and the Courts at Rewire, a media organization dedicated to covering reproductive health, rights, and justice. And Jennifer Bowen, do you see, as Executive Director of Iowa Right to Life, do you see any common ground with the pro-choice movement?
Oh, without a doubt. I encounter that on a daily basis, on a weekly basis in our organization. You know, what was mentioned in just the last comments about telemedicine, for example, telemedicine abortions, what we're finding is as we have collected petitions warning Iowans about the dangers inherent to telemedicine abortions, what we're finding as we've collected over 31,000 people in opposition to them, we have had multiple signers that have come to our booth or wherever we are and say, oh, I don't agree with you. And our response immediately is, okay, well, let's talk. And one of the things that we'll talk about, for example, is telemedicine. Do you telemedicine abortions? Are you aware of that these are going on, that there's no doctor present physically for a woman, et cetera, et cetera? We have this conversation with them. And by the end of the conversation, we hear things like, oh, I'm pro-choice, but I don't agree with this. I don't agree with telemedicine abortion, or this is too far, or I don't agree with you, but I agree with you on this. And they signed our petition. Dozens of them have signed our petition. That is a huge indication of common ground being found, that the pro-life movement so long has been identified as pro-baby only, but the conversation about telemedicine abortions in the state of Iowa has given us an excellent opportunity to really broaden people's awareness of the pro-life movement, that we care about women equally, that woman's value is equal to that unborn child. And so we've found there, I could just spend so much time telling you repeatedly how exciting it is to be a part of Iowa Right to Life right now, to be a part of the conversation in the state of Iowa, because there are so many people that as they learn more about what abortion is, and we're, even though we're all these years into it, people still are not completely aware of what's involved.
Well,
and
Jennifer, so we need to move on, but thank you so much for being a part of the conversation today. Jennifer Bowen is Executive Director of Iowa Right to Life. Mary Ziegler is still with me. She's the author of After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate. And we want to move on to talking about and to individuals who identify with these movements and may work as activists, but support these movements, and not professionally, but personally. And if you'd like to join our conversation, please do. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can call 866-780-9100. And with me now, Natalie Shira. She is pro-life and she lives in Dubuque. Hello, Natalie.
Good morning. It's a privilege to be with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you for being here. And Robin Berman is a reproductive justice advocate in Iowa City. Hello, Robin.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Robin, I want to start with you. Why or what is it that caused you to be personally committed to this movement, something that you are willing to, as an individual, fight for?
I've always identified as pro-choice and pro-woman, but it wasn't until I started getting involved with local reproductive justice organizations and clinics and started really talking to people who worked at these clinics and women who accessed abortion services before I realized how important of a fight this is, and that this isn't an issue that I could just, you know, stay silent on and not be active in, because it is a very active issue. Clearly, we can see that a lot of issues are coming up nationally as well as locally. And so I feel that this is a very, very important fight for people to be involved in. And especially as a social worker, I feel very strongly about making sure that I am fighting to secure women's access to healthcare services, including abortion services.
Was there a specific incident or a specific event that galvanized you, that made you think, this is something I need to speak up about?
I think it was really talking to clients and women who had had abortions and women who had accessed these services. I saw the range of people who accessed these services. You know, one in three women will have an abortion in her lifetime. And I saw people all across the political spectrum. I saw people all across the religious spectrum. And they all knew that they wanted to access this service and they wanted this service to be available for them. And they were thankful for that. And when I started paying attention to that, I started paying attention to the ways in which this was under attack constantly. I'm kind of a policy nerd. So as soon as I started paying attention to reproductive justice policy, I realized how fraught this was. And I realized that it's very, very important to me to engage in reproductive justice activism and to be a part of this fight. And I think meeting clients and learning more about policy really kind of radicalized me when it comes to this fight.
Natalie, I'd love to hear your personal story. What was it, what is it that made you feel so strongly about the pro-life movement that this was something you wanted to fight for?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, I would like to absolutely agree with something Robin just said. I want to thank her for sharing the idea that we're both pro-woman. And that ultimately is what this is about, and unfortunately gets lost in the divisiveness of many of these dialogues. But to answer your question, and I'll be as concise as I can, but there are three major reasons why life matters to me. The first is that many of these children are women, others aren't, but they are all alive. And we now have the biology to establish it. We have wonderful ultrasounds. We have DNA. And so my faith tells me that a child is ensouled at conception. And morally and biologically, that's something that is worth protecting, especially as women, many of whom are entrusted with the joy and the responsibility of being a mother. The other thing I would say, though, is many of our discussions now are quite political. And so in our Constitution, we have a right, among others, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's something that our founders borrowed from phenomenal philosophers like John Locke, and that's something that Jefferson especially, but many of the philosophers loved. But it's also deeply personal to me. I think about tests that were offered to my incredibly inspiring mother when she found out I was on the way, and she tried for some time to have a child and could have learned some things genetically about me, as could any mother, but particularly mine, that might have made her say, you know, I don't know, this would be a huge responsibility. I don't know what this child's quality of life would be like. And so to me, it's incredibly important, not only personally, but politically, that we preserve life in every possible way that we can.
Was there a specific event that galvanized you, that made you active?
Well, certainly learning my own story and experiencing the joy of things like, I am a very proud teacher of English, and I've had students come home from the March for Life and just tell me incredible stories about their journey. I've had the privilege of reading articles and learning about my own DNA, among other things. I'm a lot of things, but one of them is that I happen to have Turner syndrome. And so many people, you know, learning about what that means about my DNA has given me much more respect for other people's DNA and for the other choices that they may make. And I also have immense compassion for women, but I don't think the way to help them is to eliminate other men and women from the opportunity of having life. There are other really courageous options. And so the more I learn about it and the more I experience it from day to day, my goal and my objective is never, ever to question anyone, particularly I want to have compassion for women who find themselves in extraordinarily painful and emotionally difficult situations. Having said that, constitutionally, there is a right to life that really must be protected. And the more I learn in political science classes, the more I read, the more I think, the more I pray, most importantly, it becomes vital to me that we preserve life in every way we can.
I want to bring a couple other voices into this conversation. Charlie is on the line in Washington. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling. And this is an issue that's very close to your heart. Can you tell us a little about your story?
I was working in Iowa City in the middle 80s and found myself pregnant. I did not have access to health care. I was taking birth control, and I found myself pregnant. At that point in my life, having checked out several adoption clinics and different things like that, and reading the reviews on placements and what happens to some of these children after they're adopted, there's sad stories and there's positive stories. But as a human being, as a woman, and later to become a mother of three wonderful children, it was my decision, and it was a hard one, to abort that life. And that was not a decision I took lightly. And it's something I have to deal with almost daily. But that's between me and my God, as it should be for every woman. If we're going to protect life while it's still in the womb, depending on whoever's determination when life begins, like with the last caller, she had wonderful comments, but one of the issues I have a problem with is we don't support the majority of children in the United States after birth, whether they've been adopted or they're still with their birth parents. I did not want to put my child that I decided to give back to God through that type of life. Look at the number of children we have that go hungry in this country. The country's a mess, and I know people are working on it, but we need to protect everyone's civil rights, whether it's on freedoms of religion, freedom to own a gun, the freedom to make a choice that you have to live with. Unless you've been in that position, I don't feel that other people have the right to judge you on your decision because they were not in your position at the time.
Well, Charlie, thank you so much for sharing your story. And
you're welcome.
That was very brave of you to share that with us today. And Charlie was echoing some of the things that you were saying earlier, Robin, and working in social work, that's one of the arguments that comes up a lot from people. Well, if we're not willing to take care of children after they're born, then how can we tell people what kind of choices they have to make?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of structural issues within our society that make abortion a vital part of women's health care. I think that we also have to believe in the fundamental humanity of women. As someone said earlier, you know, I think that women are fully capable, moral people who are able to make their own decisions. And I believe fully in the self-determination and agency of women to access a completely legal health service. You know, they're not criminals, and we need to make sure that we're coalition building with other folks around compassion for the choices that women make. And I also, you know, I value life, but I value the life of the pregnant person above the potential life of her fetus. And I think that that's very important to make sure that we are valuing that life as important and fully formed and valuing the decisions that that woman makes with her own body.
We are out of time. Robin Berman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robin Berman is a reproductive justice advocate in Iowa City. Natalie Sherrah, thank you.
Thank you. Have a terrific day. I wish we had more time.
Me too. Natalie Sherrah is a pro-life activist. She lives in Dubuque. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.